Yes, everyone. Yep. So tonight's forum is titled, "Now the Green Blade Ri-" oh, "Now the Green Church Rises," excuse me. "Starter Seeds for Creation Care in Congregations and Daily Life." My name is Carol Tomer. I'm serving as Village Philosopher this week, and part of the role of the Village Philosopher is to listen to the conversations going on around the village and to help us have continued conversation, the things that are bubbling up among us. And tonight's forum is actually a specific response to a few who suggested that we talk together about some of these topics. A topic about how we can support one another in caring for the earth, caring for creation, and congregations, in our homes, our daily lives, our communities that we're part of. So I want to begin with part of a prayer that's found in the Evangelical Lutheran Book of Worship. Let us pray. Gracious God, you have made us co-workers in your creation. Give us wisdom and reverence to use the resources of nature so that no one may suffer from our abuse of them, and that generations yet to come may continue to praise you for your bounty. Through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. So our plan tonight is to hear a few opening comments from some panelists and then to invite our shared conversation. And I want to just share some initial thoughts that might frame our conversation. So Pilgrim is the name of my congregation. I'm in Holden right now. Holden's summer theme is the many-colored grace of God. And we see that grace all around us in creation, so colorfully arrayed in this wilderness area. Martin Luther said, "God writes the gospel not in the Bible alone, but also on trees and in the flowers and clouds and stars." And we believe our calling as Christians is to love God and love our neighbor defined as those near to us, far from us, both in time and space. And dare we see all of creation as part of all that we're called to love? St. Paul writes, "When one suffers, we all suffer together." What does that mean if we know our connectedness to creation as well? I think one of the roles of congregations is to be communities of solidarity in living out the alternative values of the gospel. We know that swimming upstream, making alternative choices, is not so easy when we do it alone. So how can we, as congregations, be those communities of solidarity? Holden being one example of that. Making some alternative choices that we believe we're called to make. We know that our society has been starting to pay attention to, you might call them green issues, as they're called these days. Earth Day started in the 1970s. And now what has followed in more recent years have been products, technologies, to help us in that path of caring for creation. Churches have more recently gotten into the act, and in a variety of ways, there's, in many of the mainline denominations now, organizations, processes where congregations can declare themselves publicly to be committed to green issues. Sometimes it's called, in Minnesota for a while, it was called Congregations Caring for Creation. My congregation declared itself to be a congregation caring for creation. Has it on all of our stuff, in the same way that we've publicly said we're a Reconciling in Christ congregation. Another public commitment, in that case, to be welcoming of LGBT people. But we've been at this for quite a while, and I'm mindful, and I shared with Sarah Pitcher that I was thinking back to when I was village pastor here in the late 80s, and dear Al Pitcher, sainted Al, was saying back then, he believed that if we drive a car that gets less than 50 miles to the gallon, we're sinning. And look where we are now, and that was the late 80s. That has rung in my ears all these years. And Holden has continued to be a leader, a witness, a mentoring community for the wider church in a variety of these things. The congregation I serve, Pilgrim Lutheran in St. Paul, has had this strong group of lay leaders around issues of caring for creation, so much so that because of their leadership, I was asked to serve a term on the board of Congregations Caring for Creation, which is now the Minnesota affiliate of Interfaith Power and Light, a national organization, one of those resources that we might be lifting up to tonight as we resource one another. And the journey for our congregation has involved a variety of things, including changing light bulbs, not using paper plates and paper cups, and making that commitment to wash dishes, and most recently, choosing to commit ourselves to the extra expense of having a metal roof coming on the sanctuary rather than an asphalt roof. And thinking about the implications of all these commitments in terms of worship and the anthropocentrism of our worship so often, and our language and our prayers and our preaching. Well, those are just some opening thoughts. We're here to resource one another, dialogue together, and so in that process, Heidi Kramer, who's been thinking about these things in a variety of ways, we've had some rich conversations this week, she's one of the folks that asked, could we have a forum on this? And so Heidi's just going to lift up a few of her questions to bring into our mix, and then we'll have a few other comments.
So one of the questions, some of the questions that I've been asking a lot, and I'd love to hear as many answers as possible too, is, one of the first ones is, are environmental sustainability and social justice issues, we talk about social justice issues a lot in Lutheran Church. I want to know, I'm curious if you feel that, are environmental sustainability and social justice issues really separate, or are they tied together? And if so, why? I mean, do we need to talk about it more, or if not, why? And if environmental sustainability is important to us, then what resources can we use and what resources are out there that we can really use to bring to our congregations and help with that? And most importantly, is what is needed for congregations to feel really safe in order to talk about stepping way out of the box into those, if you hear Pastor Chris's conversations, into those dangerous places to be forerunners in caring for our creation. How do we create a sense of safety so that we can talk about it without feeling safe? That's really the word feel. So I'm just bringing those questions forward. I'd love to hear a discussion around those, and these guys are going to address some of those too.
Thank you. So Chris Schultz is on the long-term staff here at Holden as Public Works Manager. Going to share with us some of what's been going on
in Holden and elsewhere. She says, my name is Chris. I'm the Public Works Manager. I'm an electrical engineer, and I've worked, before coming here to Holden, worked 27 years in the electric utility industry. Last 15 at Tacoma Power, working on hydro plants. But my family has been actually backing up before that, kind of that addressing the sustainability and social justice issue a little bit. I grew up in Madagascar. My parents were missionaries in Madagascar, and I remember coming back, I came back to the States when I was 14, and Madagascar has a very is very environmentally stressed. You hear a lot about it in the news that the rainforest is disappearing and animals are becoming extinct because of the pressures on habitat and the competition for habitat for human animals and plants. And I remember coming back and people saying, you know, how can those, you know, why can't they understand that they're destroying their country? By, because one of the practices is slash and burn agriculture, where you burn the forest to get new land, not only because the land you had is no longer good, but the population keeps growing. And I remember feeling, you know, well, yeah, I don't know, I'm not sure why. And then I had a chance to go back when I was an adult, and some of the, it really became clear is the choices that they're making are, do I eat next year or not? I mean, if they don't burn the forest and don't have land, they don't eat and they die. And then coming back was, you know, when we came back to the States, was kind of right in the middle of this, you know, sort of debate about global warming and us reducing our level of consumption and the outcry. How can you dare ask me to make a little bit less money this year? You know, it's not a life and death issue. Maybe it is in the long run, but it's not a day-to-day life and death issue. And so I think one of the things that has really hit me or come to me is that it's in our American lifestyle, it's inconvenient to be an environmentalist. It causes inconvenience. So things like you know, commuting to work. Well, why don't you vanpool? There's 100 people going the same direction that you're going, or take the bus. Well, it takes longer, right? And we overschedule, and so we need our car to be convenient, and so we don't do those things. And so I think it's easy to tell other people to be that you should be an environmentalist and you should reduce your level of consumption, and at the same time, it's difficult for us to do that because it takes time and it costs more, as you were saying. So, but I think, you know, and this afternoon in your session, John, I think it was Julio who came in and talked about some of the immigrant population and, you know, environment and wilderness and what it means to them. I think it's hard to be environmentally, it's hard to be environmentally conscious when you are just scratching by and just barely making it. And your day-to-day existence, that's what you're depending on. And so I think sustainability is difficult when there isn't social justice and people have resources that they can be confident that, well, have food to eat and a shelter to live in. But at the same time, my father-in-law is a pastor, and he has a saying that he says that, you know, he's very passionate about this. He says, the wolf never lets go of the meat once it's in his mouth. And essentially it's, you know, when you have, those of us that are rich and have, we don't want to give that up. We hang on to it. It's ours. And, you know, we talk about how do we make, how can we allow justice for everybody? It means we have to let go and let them have some of the meat that Chris was having. So that's my thoughts on that first question. I did want to talk a little bit, just opening as far as the environmental, how do we support support each other. You know, Holden has been, has had a profound impact on my family. We came up here, and I, as guests, we've been coming for about 10 or 12 years, I think, and it's funny, the first time we came, we heard stuff about food, and, you know, food grown locally, community-supported agriculture. It's like, yeah, that's really good, you know, some of the food justice issues, and we went home and did nothing. We kind of continued on with what we were doing, and then came back the next year, and the similar topics were being discussed. And and on the way back, I remember my wife and I talking, you know, this, we're going to do something about it this time. And found near our house a local farmer that we could subscribe to and, you know, start buying our food locally. And it costs more, you know, and it's a little bit inconvenient. You had to go get it every day. But it was interesting then that our food became much more variety than we did, and we all were a lot healthier. In fact, when in the wintertime we quit, because it was all they were going to give us was greens, and I was like, yeah, let's just wait till spring share. And within 3 weeks we were all sick and went back and got our greens. So I think, you know, there's benefits to this kind of this stuff. But so that was one that we changed, and then our church had a big open lot that, you know, was for expansion, and it just sat there and we didn't do anything with it. And for years we grew weeds, and that's all we grew, and every year was a big debate about who was going to cut the weeds down. And a friend of ours who spent time here on staff came back, and so we started a community garden project up on our weed patch that now is growing food for the neighborhood and providing food for our shelter. And so I think there's simple ways, don't take a lot of money or effort, but you can live more sustainably. And churches can do that. So I'll stop now and we can talk more later.
Okay.
John Jensen. Teaching staff from Luther College.
Yeah, I teach at Luther College and want to talk just a little bit about Luther, but also to try to address these questions briefly and then hopefully open it up from there as well. I want to start with resources just because I think that's, in some ways, that's maybe it's the easiest, at least a couple of things. Carol mentioned Interfaith Power and Light, which I think is sort of a growing movement nationally, and I think they have some tremendous resources. Like lots of things, they're sort of stronger in some states than others. They have a very strong program in Iowa and have a good website, and I think it's a good place to sort of get resources and information about what's working in other places and to not feel like you have to sort of invent the wheel. ELCA, as I understand, has also been building a website of resources on creation care. I know more about what they're doing on the sort of campus sustainability side on these ELCA schools, but I think there's lots of stuff for congregations there as well. Yeah. But my number one sort of bit of advice in terms of resources is if you're thinking about your own congregation, in some ways I feel like this is the worst advice you can give, is form a committee. But I think what I find is that individuals feel like they're all alone and they're just sort of beating their heads against the wall and nobody else cares about it whatsoever. And the solidarity of a group of people within a congregation that is working together, that is sharing ideas, that is commiserating, if nothing else. But I just think there's tremendous power in feeling like you're not alone, but there is a group of people that are there. And it may seem like there's nobody else in your congregation that cares, but I think in every case there is. It's just that you may not have identified or you may not be aware that they have that same sort of view again. And I just think it's really important that people feel like there is that sort of connection of others to work with from there. The question about what's needed to feel safe to talk about these issues, I want to answer in two somewhat contradictory ways. I think the first thing to do is to say, from my point of view, church is not a place to feel safe. Church ought to be a place where we are challenged. Otherwise, we have completely lost the notion of what Christ was about, if you ask me. And I think far too many congregations are in the business of trying to make people feel safe and comfortable. And I understand that. Congregations, like lots of organizations, are very much in the business of self-preservation. But I think some of the thriving churches actually thrive partly because they're willing to step outside the box and not worry so much about ruffling feathers at times. So I think that's a sort of understanding what does it mean to be a church, what does it mean to be a Christian, that needs to come. That said, I'll offer a little bit of my sort of advice on how you make people feel safe, because I sort of pragmatically to think about it from there. For me, part of it is choosing your language carefully. I think a lot of progress can be made if we don't talk about environmentalism and we don't talk about sustainability, but we do talk about stewardship and we do talk about creation care. When you rephrase your rhetoric so that there are clearer ties to the Christian mission, and you sort of break some of the ties to the incredible sort of political polarization that comes along with environmental issues in our society today, I think you can often get further. When you talk about local food instead of talking about sustainable agriculture, I think when you talk about healthy, you talk about sort of supporting the local economy, people are on board. People often feel threatened if they feel like it challenges in some ways their political beliefs. And I mean, I don't know where you come from, but as a demographic, Christians are fairly politically conservative. And I think it's incredibly unfortunate that environmental issues have been painted as liberal issues, and that sort of there is a piece of conservative political rhetoric that says you have to be sort of anti-environmental. So I think finding ways to try to depoliticize and to make more sort of to use Christian language, even if ultimately you're talking about the same things, I think is just a really effective strategy. But it also, it keeps us to the core mission of our churches. And I think that's an important sort of thing. So choosing your rhetoric carefully. The other thing I would say is choosing your issues. There's a tremendous amount of interest around food these days. And whether that's community supported agriculture, whether that's community gardens. I mean, I just love hearing these stories. But I think people come together around food. And I think there's lots of there's lots of good connections to both social justice and to sort of creation care through food issues. And unfortunately, the most hot button issue in our society these days is climate change. And I think that's one that can be harder to do from there. The Interfaith Power and Light has a program they call Cool Congregations, trying to get congregations to talk about climate change and to work with it, but it's a difficult thing. It's hard. If you look at the studies, the number of people who say that they believe in climate change or that humans are a cause of it is going down in the United States. That sort of we're moving, and as the scientists become more and more confident, the general public sort of is moving in the opposite direction from there. So one of the things I've seen congregations with that issue is, again, not necessarily talking about climate change, but sometimes I know congregations have been quite effective in sort of focusing more on money issues to say that if we can make our church more energy efficient, we save money. And I've never met a church that is opposed to saving money. And it can make a big difference. At Luther College, we have cut our electricity usage by 25% in the last 5 years. And that is, you can say, okay, here's how many tons of greenhouse gas emissions, but you can also say that reduces our utility bill by about $250,000 a year. And that was done through fairly simple through efficiency changes. It's not just light bulbs, but it's things like that that can make a difference. So again, sort of choosing how do you approach that issue. And there are lots of congregations that have done good things, but it's not, I guess the other thing would be sometimes it makes sense in my mind to focus kind of on church operations, whether that is fair trade coffee that's being served at coffee time, whether that's energy usage. And sometimes I think it's reaching out to individual members of the congregation. The Cool Congregations program does workshops where they will have individual people who voluntarily choose to sort of bring in their utility bills and figure their carbon footprint, and then voluntarily say, here's something that I think I can do to reduce my energy usage, which also reduces your home heating bills or your home electricity usage. I'm very conscious that it's a little different, say, in the Midwest than it is in the Northwest. Heating is a much bigger expense for us than it is here, and your electricity is incredibly cheap. So you can reduce a lot and not save a lot of money comparatively from there. So thinking about that, but also thinking about this in terms of kind of educational opportunities and how does this tie into sort of Christian education. And for clergy, I do think there's a piece of this that ultimately needs to find its way into the pulpit and needs to find its way into our theology, not just thinking about those sort of individual practices. I was on sabbatical a couple of years ago and attended a UCC church in Lincoln, Nebraska. It was wonderful. They had an environmental committee, and they did various workshops for people coming in. And some of it was very simple things. I mean, they did cooking classes because they find that lots of people can't eat as healthy or can't use those greens because they don't know how to cook with them at all. But not once in the year that I was there did anything related to this ever find its way into the pulpit. And I think if there's that sort of disconnect, that's a problem as well. So, I've used more than 3 minutes, I'm sorry. And we can open it up. And
great. So those are some opening thoughts and questions, and we're all here as resources for one another. So what thoughts do you have to share?
It strikes me that, you know, we can take really meaningful steps in small congregations and as individuals, but that policy change is necessary. And I wonder what the role of church communities is in trying to create the groundswell necessary to convince our body politic that that is feasible and important and timely. I mean, that's dangerous ground for churches often, but this seems like a set of issues that is worth entering that dangerous zone for. I wonder if you all have thoughts on that or others.
Well, groups like IPL will send out advocacy alerts.
Sure.
So that's one aspect of a congregation saying we're going to care about these issues, helping people get those emails and things. Like on any other issues that we try to...
Sure, but I mean, so IPL is sort of going this way as far as public presence, right? And our thoughts, our belief in climate change is going this way, right? So I don't feel like that. I'm a founding member of the New Hampshire group, and I think they do great work, but, you know, it's not working, right? They are increasing in their efficacy while people are believing less and less in what they're saying. And that strikes me as a problem, needless to say.
What do y'all think?
Well, we've got some media on the other side that is the reason for that, I think. The media that wants to tell lies is essentially
has anybody figured out why the public is so hostile toward the idea that the environment is changing? What is it that's driving that hostility?
Yeah, some very extremely sophisticated marketing companies did a lot of focus group research being funded by companies that sell energy and consumer goods. The same sort of people that devise these clever ads that get you hooked on smoking cigarettes and all that stuff. I mean, it's in their vested interest to create the same disinformation campaign, the one that went on for 30 or 40 years trying to convince people that smoking cigarettes was not only harmless, but it was beneficial to your health, you know? And people, actors dressed up as doctors saying, yes, smoke Camels to soothe your nerves. Well, the same thing is going on with energy today. Companies benefit from us buying more stuff. I mean, ultimately, what are people looking for? Meaning? They're looking for purpose. They're looking for fellowship. And consumerism is just sort of a hollow alternative to that. And this is where the churches can play an extremely valuable role by offering people a sense of purpose, Christ-centered purpose and fellowship. And if you have all that stuff, you don't need to buy a lot of stuff to fill up this void in your heart, you know? And that's where I think churches can really make a difference.
Julio.
Thank you. Oh, that's a very good point. Yeah, I was just thinking, you know, because I'm an economist, right? That the supply of ideology side, then on the demand side, I think that people appreciate those kind of rationalizations because not having them entails some sense of responsibility to do something. And so we prefer to, you know, we are comforted by the thought that, oh, it's not real, or if it's real, it's not really because of humans have, you know, created the problem. And so it's a pacifying thought, I think. So it kind of fits that way. But I would also like to quickly comment on and what you said about, you know, changing policy. Yeah, and you know, to affect changing policy, you know, you have to participate in politics. And I think that there, you know, I think that it's great, you know, that people are taking initiatives, even if they are at the individual level, you know, even better if they are the, you know, the congregational level or interfaith or, you know, whatever it involves more people, the better. But I think, and just the example that John mentioned, which also, you know, connects with what Chris was saying about Madagascar, the experience in Madagascar, right? That people, you know, have to make very hard choices. And I can think of Brooklyn in urban settings, kind of working class neighborhoods that are now being ravaged by unemployment and, you know, foreclosures and things like that. You know, how hard it is for people to make the switch to changing your lifestyle and doing those things. Even the case that you mentioned, John, about, you know, you save money by changing your, you know, refitting your church, your building, so that, you know, you make it more energy efficient. Even in that case, policy is involved because there are some subsidies, mm-hmm. that, you know, or tax breaks that you get, and that is really what, you know, where they, at this point, because those, you know, otherwise it wouldn't, the economics of that wouldn't be there. So I think that the way I think of it is, like, I'm remembering a book written by Billy Gates, The Road Ahead, in the early 2000s, where he confessed, if I remember correctly, that he had to remove games like Solitaire and, you know, Minesweeper from his hard disk. He deleted them because if he had them there, he was tempted to, you know, because he was addicted to playing games on the computer. So it was very telling to me that a person who was obviously, you know, high performance, high power kind of guy, right? CEO of Microsoft. And that he had to somehow, prevent him to make it harder for himself to do things, mm-hmm. right? We are so pulled by different forces inside of us that we sometimes have to take this kind of measures against our worst selves. And I think that, you know, that policy plays that role, mm-hmm. you know, like acting through you know, the civic mechanisms, the political system, political participation, because markets do exactly the opposite. Markets disintegrate us. They, you know, they make us feel like super self-reliant, which we are not, mm-hmm. and just look after our own narrow self-interest in the more like, you know, foot-shooting way, mm-hmm. you know? And so I think that policy, you know, like passing legislation that forces us to make the right consumer choices mm-hmm. at a mass scale, so that it's not just going to be like, it's like in my case, like putting a lock on the refrigerator, mm-hmm. so that I, you know, I'm not tempted to go on, you know, and keep eating.
It sounds like such a good Lutheran approach, that both and, in a sense, that, you know, at the same time that we've got to work on policy things, we can't live in a manner inconsistent with the future for which we hope. So whereas changing light bulbs might seem trivial, it's not going to, and all the other things that congregations wrestle with, that we all wrestle with every time we go to the store or make any other decision, that we have to do that wrestling and make some of those choices at the same time, that simile, that wonderful, at the same time, we have to figure out how to put those policies, those incentives, et cetera, in place, get the minesweepers of our environmental decay off of the dashboard. Or, interesting, helpful analogy.
I was just thinking, John was naming something that I think is really true. It's got to also come out of the pulpit. Because the pulpit is one of the places that story is told. And there's been storytellers in all Aboriginal cultures. And in the Lutheran system, pastor tends to function as the storyteller, and they tell the story as they know it and as they're aware of it. And it strikes me that, having graduated from seminary 4.5 years ago, I don't remember anything that directed me to specifically interpret. Well, there's a little bit, but no, I wasn't really challenged to see scripture through a lens that asked me about global sustainability. There were bits of it. But it tended to be all the creation texts. It, you know, wasn't a central piece. And yet, Fox News is busy 24 hours a day telling us we have nothing to worry about. And it's funded by, you know, all the corporations that our 401ks are tied up in.
Yeah.
You know, and so there's this systemic involvement that we're all connected in. I think the church has a critical role, even as we recognize that we're losing ground. You know, in Oregon, 3% of people go to any kind of church at all on Sunday morning. So 3% of the population are even going to hear this story. In my town, most of the people that come to town are Fox News people. I mean, the people that come to church aren't coming to churches that are concerned about sustainability stuff. But there is a sliver of the population that is listening if we're aware that we actually need to be thinking and speaking in those terms. And it may not be the pulpit that's as effective as the small adult Bible studies, but there's a... Now, I think if we keep pushing on barges, the barges eventually move. These people, they experience transformation through that understanding of the gospel that becomes good news to them that they share. And it's, part of why our church is dying, is because we're dodging these issues. We don't realize that we have legitimate traction with our culture, and God cares deeply about this. This is social justice stuff that's all over the province. And so I think the church is missing a golden opportunity to be vibrant in the next 50 years, you know, if we've got that, by engaging this out of the pulpit, and particularly in the small groups where we can really reflect with people, honestly, the pulpit can be a little heavy-handed.
Mm-hmm. I just would say, I mean, back to the policy change bit, I think we need to see all of these actions, from our individual choices about what we eat to what's happening in the pulpit to church operations, as laying the groundwork for broader policy, and I would just say system change from there. And personally, I'm not as worried about churches getting members of their congregation to write their senators to say, hey, I would like you to support this cap and trade bill. I just think we're not in a place, unfortunately, right now where we're likely to be able to pass significant environmental legislation. And what we need to do, from my point of view, is think a little bit long term and try to be telling the stories, be taking all the little actions that hopefully prepare things for when the time is right for us to make more dramatic changes. I mean, as somebody who studies policy, at least partly, I mean, one of the concepts that I find useful is thinking about policy windows. We are very reactive in the way that we make policy. And things happen, and a window of opportunity opens, and what seemed impossible a year ago can actually change pretty quickly. But I do think that it's scary to say that, because we needed to change 30 years ago. We don't need to change 5 years in the future, but at some point too, we're not accomplishing much by sort of politicizing these issues in the current climate, I don't think, because I think you risk actually turning more people off, whereas sometimes the slow and steady multi-pronged approach, although you don't even see an impact, has effects on people that will change them, so hopefully it's there. I mean, we need to revamp the whole system. It needs to be dramatically economic in a way that it makes it easier and cheaper for people to do the right thing, as opposed to thinking, I've got to make sacrifices and I've got to spend more money in order to do it. And we've got to make those changes. And we will, because we have to. But that doesn't mean we're going to do it now, and it doesn't mean it's going to be easy. But I think the church needs to lead in that effort. But I think, I'm not sure the way to lead is through letter-writing campaigns and sort of engaging in that sort of political part of it in the short term. But thinking about what I do now sort of hopefully laying the groundwork for something broader over time.
I'd like to add that on the policy end, that I think it's hard for people to want to work to change policy unless they believe in the issue. So unless churches and the congregations and the people in them are really living, believing and doing this stuff, they're not going to be prepared to work for policy changes. So congregations have to begin absorbing that and becoming it first. And when we see that, then they'll probably see them advocating policy change, which is, like you said, down the road, unfortunately. But also on the other side of that, as more people become and live it, it's going to become more sustainable, even without policy change, you know, because people will be starting to live the things. And then policy change can maybe be more organic from that side of it, as well as top-down, up-down, down, meet somewhere in the middle, and hopefully it will be in time.
Yeah. What I hear is 5% change. That's what I hear. Different light bulbs, different room. And what we need is a 50% change. And so if I admit there's a climate change issue, I need to occupy half as much space, half as much utilities, half as much food by going down in the food, you know, eating beans instead of meat, and that sort of thing. And then half as much consumption, there go our jobs. You know, there's just a lot of ramifications to all this. So if people don't buy TV sets, there's more jobs that are gone. And so we're talking big dislocation in the United States.
Yep. Bingo. I also think there will be tremendous new, on the economic front, I think there'll be tremendous new opportunities for new employment as things come up. And there's a lot of really smart people writing about this stuff too. I mean, here in, I think he's here in Washington, David Corton has a wonderful book called Agenda for a New Economy, where trying to lay out a vision for what this is going to look like. And I think the question is not, is the 5% enough, but is the 5% a meaningful step in the direction of that 50%, or to be honest, the 95% that I think we're ultimately looking at along the way. And figuring out how you do that. And it's not saying, hey, I'm doing this and therefore I'm green and it's wonderful. It's saying, is this a step in the right direction towards that broader systemic change?
Jen? I'm thinking about, I'm on sabbatical right now, so I haven't been thinking about my congregation very much at all, to be really honest, which is good. But now I'm sitting here thinking about some work that we've been doing over the last 7 years, let's say, all in the name of sustainability, of big old church building, really, really old church building in the city, can't afford it, what do you do? And all that ties up to environmental stuff of, it costs too much to heat this place. You know, we're not able to do it well. And then stewardship comes into the question. And how do you deal with people's stewardship and how do you deal with building stewardship? And then in the more recent years of having kind of gone through the changes, okay, we got to make a change of saying we're going to chop off half our land and sell it and tear it down and let them build affordable housing, but then we're going to renovate this other part of the space. And how do you do that? And in our case, it's our congregation and now two other congregations of different denominations making decisions together about how do you renovate this big old building and sitting for all these years now with our architects and then our developers and then our subcontractors and contractors thinking very intentionally of, and I can think of a few people's voices, you know, we need to make sure that we take care of that lead paint. We need to work on abatement. We need to think about what kind of, you know, who are the workers working on this building? We need to think about all these different levels of, and how much can we afford, but how much are we going to get payoff in the long run, and what's that mean in this big system? And so-and-so saying, well, in my house when we did such and such, we were able to do it in this sustainable way, and that made this difference. And then we applied that to this big $4 million project. And it's so interesting to see us, all of us, and both the development people, like the design people, but also kind of the leadership groups, thinking on a very local level, this is what I do with my family, and then what do we do in our congregations as we work together and make these decisions? And so it's kind of like this education process for all of us about how do we make these kinds of decisions and what do we value, and always having to keep coming back to this is what we value and that might cost more, but kind of holding as communities ourselves accountable to that, those kind of decisions that just keep being made over and over and over. So it's really interesting. Sometimes I think, oh, we don't really have to think about this in that congregation. Well, God, we think about it constantly. And it's been such a big process, and I'm also really resonating with that question of, do we preach it? Do we talk about it? Do we do it in small groups? My answer would be we do it in all these ways, as well as in leadership teams and those other kinds of levels that happen, because it's just so vital in so many ways, and it does come up in so many different ways. So you're just making me think about it. Thank you.
What about empowering the children? Mm. The kids want a rainforest when they grow up. They want all kinds of things. And in Costa Rica, they started the children's rainforest because some kids, I think in Sweden or something, heard that there weren't going to be certain kind of birds when they grew up. And they said, well, we want it. And they have a place now. But how do we empower the kids? Because they're the ones that are going to be here.
Get them outside. The research is pretty clear, I think, that the single most important sort of factor for adult environmental values is, well, two things. One is regular time outside, and the second piece is with an adult mentor or some sort of adult that is a meaningful person in that kid's life. The rainforest is a great example, I think, because there was a lot of work that's been done in elementary school populations on sort of making them aware of rainforest issues. The research that I've seen on child development says if you inform kids, particularly early elementary, about environmental issues, it tends to backfire. That they're not developmentally ready, basically, to deal with big issues like this. So the person that I would recommend on this issue is a guy named David Sobel that has written a series of books. But one of the best ones, which is really short, I like short books, is called Beyond Ecophobia, which is sort of trying to deal with some of these issues. But Sobel says, no tragedies before fourth grade. That his work with kids and with teachers sort of shows that just getting kids outside and giving them those connections to natural places. And it doesn't have to be a wilderness, as we were talking about before. I mean, it can be the schoolyard outside, I think, is will have the longest term effect. And he sort of goes through developmental stages and talks about what is appropriate for different kids at different periods. But he's got a nice article on climate change that basically says we really shouldn't be talking to young kids about climate change. It's not, even though it may be this huge issue and you don't want to sort of intentionally sort of shield them from it, it's not the right approach with kids. But increasingly, kids in our society spend less and less time outside and more time in front of screens. And that's, again, Sobel says, kids need at least as much real reality as virtual reality. And I just saw this statistic the other day. I don't know what the number of hours of screen time that kids get in an average week, and it just sort of blows me away. And the number of schools that are eliminating recess. And that's, I think, driven largely by the sort of high-stakes testing, No Child Left Behind type stuff. But whatever we can do to sort of get kids outside, I think, is the single most important part of it. And not feeling like we have to sort of presenting environmental issues or these big tragedies, particularly at a certain level.
Now there's even something called nature deficit disorder, isn't
there?
Yeah.
Maria! I wanted to say that the second grade teacher at the school I've been going to for the past few years buys an acre of rainforest every year to protect it. Mm-hmm. And the class gets to vote on what rainforest they want.
I wanted to respond, Linda, to one of the comments that you made, Linda, about losing our job, you know, our economy. You talked about if we cut back on spending or whatever, that we lose our jobs and that our economy, you know, our economy is dependent on spending. And I think, I've heard others talk about it, but I think that we as Americans have talked ourselves into a trap on that whole issue that we got to spend, and what do we do? We throw away. And we had our 4th of July parade here, and one of the things you learn here is garbology. And the side of their float, they had a sign that said, "One man's garbage is another man's garbage." The garbology. Essentially, it was that he's the one that gets it all. You know, we throw it away around here. He ends up with it and has to figure out what to do with it. And I think our society, we've talked ourselves into, or the media has talked us into it, or the corporations that we need to buy. And you know, one of the things I've often thought a church could do is, or churches could do is, if you took a poll in your congregation, every family that has a house probably has a lawnmower. Why do we all have lawnmowers? You use it once a week. Why can't you have like the church have 10 lawnmowers that everybody checks out and uses and puts back and the next person takes, instead of all of us buying lawnmowers or shovels or whatever? You know, you think about all the things in your garage or in your house that just sit there. You gotta have it because you might need it. And I think our society, the capitalism or whatever has taught us that we need to have we don't want to depend on anybody. And I had a interesting experience, kind of, I want to flip between Madagascar and here. In Madagascar, if you have a car and you're going somewhere, you're not going alone. There's probably a, you know, 100 people asking you for a ride, and all the space is taken up to go wherever you want. Here, everybody has a car, and there's one person usually in the car. And, I had a, when I was working for Tacoma Power, they had incentives to reduce this ride reduction, you know, program to encourage people to vanpool. Well, it turned out in my neighborhood there was a van, and it didn't cost me anything. It's like getting a free ride to work. All you had to do was catch the vanpool, and it picked me up at my door. But I was also involved with I had a Thursday morning Bible study that I went to on my way to work. And so I couldn't ride the vanpool. But I had a couple friends that went to this Bible study that happened to work right next to where I worked. And I remember thinking, I can drive my car to go to the Bible study and go to work and then drive home, or I could ask one of my friends who's lives near me, going to the Bible study, and works near me, I could ask him for a ride. And I remember really struggling, feeling like I was imposing on him to ask for a ride. You know, he lived a couple blocks away, and he worked half a mile from where I worked. And it wasn't until I sat down and I said, you know, I asked a few times, and then finally I kind of shared with him what I was feeling. I feel like I'm imposing, and he kind of laughed and said, you know, I really look forward to these morning drives when I'm not driving by myself and we get to talk on the way to work. But I think that is a picture sometimes of the way we live our lives. We want to be so self-dependent and individual. I got to take care of myself, and I don't want to impose on anybody, that we do stupid things like driving to work by ourselves instead of with somebody else. Yeah.
Yeah.
So I'd like to share too, that's a great thing. Just because John was sharing about how food is a great place to start in your church. I haven't done this yet, but I have an idea in my head that I might eventually start either with my church, if I can form the committee, or outside of it. But I'll throw this out here, because if there's anyone that this is just a start for ideas. Because in our town, I've noticed that there are a lot of old people in houses with lawns, or even gardens. Gardens they used to garden, now they're kind of lawns. They're not able to take care of them anymore. I've also noticed there is a large sector of poorer people who need food, and there's not enough community garden space, and they are kind of interested in growing things or saving money. And I thought, what if we could be a resource for connecting some of these older folks who have the land and all the tools and all the everything but can't do anything with some of these from other people? Maybe they don't even have to be poor. Maybe they just want, they're in apartment dwellers, you know, and they don't have any land, whatever it is. And we connect them, we provide, you know, some sort of safety screening process or whatever it is. But we get them connected up and well matched, and the people who don't have land can provide labor. And they can grow the food in these people's yards, they can, you know, the people at the land can provide whatever's needed, the seeds, the whatever, and then they can share the food. And you could go to the Master Gardeners and ask them to help with education on how to grow and care for the food and do all that kind of stuff, which they'd probably be more than happy to do. Permaculture people, if there's any in your town, would love to do that kind of thing. So there's resources for people to come and help educate. People need education on how to grow food and how to preserve it and how to do all those things. So I've been thinking lately, you know, what if we use, you know, and to me that combines social injustice and environmental sustainability and local food issues and all those things, that you're providing, helping people and creating community between people that, you know, some of these older people never hardly ever come out of their houses, and to have some, you know, people on board. They might even have yards where the parents are working, and safe for the children to run free and actually experience that. You know, there could be these multiple levels of things going on. So anyway, throw that out there in case anyone goes home to their congregation and knows some gardener who's really interested. Maybe you could start something similar or something like that in yours. So.
We have a green team in our church. It's a Presbyterian church in Bend, Oregon, and we have managed to sign on to the whatever the Presbyterian church is equivalent of caring. So we got stamped as we've got a plaque that we are Creation Care Church Congregation or something. But one of the things, so we do have support. We struggle sometimes and get discouraged because the pulpit isn't always you know, backing us up as much as we'd like. But one thing I started was a green tea movie night, and it's actually not that well attended by the church, but it helps me a lot. I get it in the newspaper, and we've shown Gasland, and I subscribe to Iron Reef Film Club, and they send me a movie every month. It's $20 a month, and I heard about it through Green America, and they have been just wonderful. In fact, I brought two of them with me. They do a lot of different issues. Some of the movies have been social justice. Beyond Belief is a movie about these two widows who lost their husbands in 9/11, and I showed that for one of the nights. So it's not always just environment, but we've done some peace and justice too. But anyway. Vanishing of the Bees with me. If anybody wants to see that, we should show it sometime. It's pretty amazing. I've learned so much because, I mean, there's so many good books, but it's so hard to read. Find time to read, and you're watching this film with a bunch of people, and then you have discussion after.
Thank you. I'm aware of the hour. Yeah, Julio.
Can I just quickly try to confront this issue that, you know, that pop up here? You know, on the one hand, you know, your argument back there that I try to substantiate as well, that, you know, that policy changes are required, that it's really fundamental, and that rather than leaving it up to individuals or even congregations, or that all those initiatives are valuable, but that they may not be sufficient. And then on the other hand, the issue that John poses, that at least in some congregations, that I would understand the matter that way, right? That at least in some congregations, those constituencies may not be ready to confront these issues, like, you know, in a straightforward manner, but that you have to choose your language, etc. Which I think it is very important. It is very important that you don't alienate people more than they may already be. So you want to incorporate them, and you want to build bridges to help them. You know, now in some other congregations that may not be a dilemma. I mean, you know, it seems like in your case, right, that you can openly talk about those issues and people are supportive. But so. It may have to be done like outside of the framework of the church, at least in those cases where the congregation is not ready. But I think that kind of commitment to politics, it seems to be indispensable if we want to get a breakthrough.
Mm-hmm. As I was walking in, I heard somebody mention the power of Fox News, and I was thinking about that, and I thought of a slogan, and I don't know what you would think, maybe it's been used, but say something to the effect of church, the real fair and balanced channel. Or Jesus invented fair and balanced. That's a way to get back to Fox News.
any last thoughts?
I have one.
Yes.
People tend to do what their neighbors do. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're confronted with a new idea, you look around, you try to find a friend or a neighbor who's already tried it, who will say, this works, mm-hmm. you know. And so that's, I mean, just like Christ talks about, it's right, being salt, or being leaven, or that's us. So if we have a rain garden in our front yard, if we talk about, you know, I switched out all my light bulbs and my electric bill dropped by $30 a month, just make this appealing, friendly, and doable, and starting communities, you know, like your movie, Community. If you just tell people the world is coming to an end unless you do all of these things that they've never heard of before, I mean, you put people in this quandary, you know, in this depressing state of mind. They tune you out, and they tune Fox News on, who says, everything's wonderful, you know? So, just be an example, and there's nothing more powerful than an idea whose time has come, and this idea is coming, we don't know when. I mean, I live just an hour away from Joplin, Missouri, that had a terrible tornado. That's part of climate change, I think. You know, there's enough tornadoes, enough whatever. All of a sudden, the mood of the nation will change. And if we're spread out all over the country doing these things that create community and make people feel good, help save the earth, people are going to turn to us and say, well, tell me more about this. I know you've been doing this for a while. So I think it's great that we're all here talking. This is wonderful. This will make a difference.
And I think when the church can be public about it, like Salem English is pretty public about their renovations, their green space, and my congregation, Zion, is a, you know, it's this public fixture in the Dalles, right across the street from the high school. And it's this big old building with a big old slate roof. And that roof's going to come off in a few years because when we did some elevator work, we discovered the tar paper's all brittle. And the tar paper is part of what sheds the rain on an old concrete tile roof. So we're going to have to put a new roof on, and we have this gorgeous southern exposure in a town that sees 13 inches of rain a year. You know, we have this enormous capacity for solar generation. Mm-hmm. They would be on a public street corner that would make incredible economic sense to this congregation. And if I know, if we put that on our roof, so we're working the story right now with the church council, just, you know, mm-hmm. they talked about the tar paper's cracked, and we have to think about doing a capital improvement here in about 5 years. Right away, we're saying, well, if we do that, we might also be thinking about shifting over our whole way that we heat and cool the building. Move to heat pumps, generate our own power, run our meters backwards, and give some of that power to the PUD to subsidize utility bills for the poor, and then be public about the whole thing. Mm-hmm. And I think that's an opportunity we can't afford to miss, at least where my church sits. Mm-hmm. If they miss it, I'll be so mad. But I'm doing everything I can in my power to just gently change the story so that they get it, because our electricity is so cheap, we could afford not to do it also. But long term, when we start thinking 50 years of utility bills, and if we can pay off the solar panels in 10 years, we'd have 40 years of no electrical bill. That's significant. Mm-hmm. You know, we could hire a youth director. Oh.
Well, I'd like to go back to one of the comments John made about congregations, and, you know, it's a place, it should be a place where you're uncomfortable or that you're challenged, and encourage people, you know, if your church isn't ready, I mean, careful about the rhetoric or whatever, but don't be afraid to bring up the issue, because sometimes that generates the discussion. I had an experience in the church that I was a part of. Every year we passed a budget where we gave 10% away to benevolences, but we never did. I mean, it was in the budget, but we never did, because it was never any money left at the end of the year. It was the last thing. And so I brought it up at a congregational meeting, said, you know, we do this, why don't we just pick a number? You know, so I made a proposal, 5%. It was a big uproar.
Oh, we can't afford that.
You know, and we were going to do it first. And so I said, okay, I'll take it back. How about 3%? We pay it off the top right away. And it went to a vote, and it didn't pass. And it was no. And it would, and you know, I left the congregation, I can't believe we can't even give 3% away. When you say it, we give 10. But everybody else in the congregation was thinking, I can't believe that didn't pass. And so the next congregation meeting. I didn't even make the proposal. It came up from the council. We're going to start 5% and we'll go up percent per year until we get to 10. It was the bringing the issue up. I mean, we've been going for years without paying any benevolences, and then it was like, what? So I would say, don't be afraid to bring the issue up. It may not pass right away. It may cause, stir the pot.
Well, thank you all for this fine conversation, important conversation, and an ongoing conversation. In these days here together, and in all the days and places to come. So thank you so much for your witness, and for the joy of being together on this journey of faith and life in our world. Thank you.